Cheerfully thought about and what doubt's a well-known expression, but it's Freud's idea. But after all, religion is an erotic adjustment to life on the part of those who aren't grown up enough to face life without mother and father. And that actually man has created God because he needs it, rather than God having created man. Now everybody, I think, sooner or later, wonders about this. But here's somebody who said it out loud as an affirmation. Or Eric Fromm's doubt becomes a faith. Namely, that God is the highest expression of human aspiration. And thus, in worshiping God, we're worshiping the highest of human ideals, and God is a symbol for this. And says Fromm, perhaps we've grown up enough as a culture to dispense with the symbol. And just call it love. And it's the scandal of many religions. You know, not just the many denominations within Christendom, but then all the religions of the world, and the world becoming smaller, these religions become more important in the eyes of the Christian world. The Arab-Israeli conflict bringing to a focus different religions in the Holy Lands, focus for all of them. Then the great Eastern religions. And now the problems we're having even in our own country with the rise of the black Muslims and so on. But can they all be right? How often we've wondered that. Everybody thinks they're right. Who's fooling who? Maybe they're all a bunch of make-believe. We want proof, and yet we know we can't have proof. We listen to the story of Thomas when he says, unless I could put my hand into the sword print, wound to the side, and my fingers into the nail prints of his hand, I cannot, I will not believe. You say, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Lucky Thomas. And then, of course, in our advanced courses in Bible, maybe we hear that this is the early church's approach to this, and maybe it never happened anyhow, and the doubts take on full speed. This is really, and we perhaps realize it when it goes on, an immature rebellion against reality. We're protesting against our given, protesting against the very life that we've been placed into. It's offense at faith in the frustration of the desire to walk by sight. And knowing one can't walk by sight in the kind of habit that we've been placed in. And yet belief in God persists in spite of this lack of proof. I think in spite of the fact that far too much is being made of it commercially, I think it's rather an amazing fact that the daughter of the arch-atheist Stalin should seek baptism within the Russian Church. Or the story of Helen Keller, who couldn't communicate with the outer world, when finally through her gift of mentor she was able to break through and was told what God is or who God is, and she replied, oh, I've known about him all along. That's amazing. William James, one of the earliest psychologists of religion, wrote his famous book, The Varieties of Experience, in which he said that the door of the intellect is only one door into consciousness. Then he spoke about what he called the inner door to consciousness. The inner door through which religious experience entered. A door in which intuitive perception and knowledge seems to be more predominant than rational perception. And Jerome Bruner, the educator in our own day, who has popularized much of modern education as problems and dilemmas, says that one of our lacks, as far as he can see in our educational scene, is our overemphasis on the rational in educational processes and our almost complete lack of the intuitive road to knowledge. Now from this intellectual focus in faith, we go one step backward, we should say that, to the dynamic of relationship. and raise the question, is the intellectual focus in Tao, which seems to be the primary focus, but a symptom? I'm thinking of Paul's statement, I know whom I believe in, and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. Not I know what, I know whom I believe in. Religion is essentially a relationship. The intellect has a profound dependence on the emotions, which most highly intellectual people are reluctant to admit. But it's amazing how pessimistic people develop pessimistic philosophies of life, and optimistic people develop optimistic philosophies to life, and how we think one way when we feel one way, and think another way when we feel the other way, and how our reason can become quite a slave to our feelings, and we think emotionally. The emotions, however, are also dependent. They're dependent on our relationships. I'm thinking of a young man who had a profound problem over what we're talking about, that is, faith, and talked to his pastor about it. And they went through all the intellectual problems, and finally through the process of counseling, they began to talk about his relationships. And here was a young man who was having a violent conflict with his dad. His dad was quite an authoritarian person, and up until now he had ruled the roost. But now this young man, who we can call Randy for want of a better name, was beginning to fight this authoritarian father, and questioning whether he was always right, and demanding to have his place in the sun. And the projection to the authority God was unconscious, but nevertheless definite. And he began to see that he couldn't separate his problem over faith from his problem with authority on this side of religion. Or the young lady who said, the isolation I feel from other people extends also to God. Namely, that we can't separate our relationships with people from our relationship with God, and vice versa, because they are interrelated, something we should know from our scripture, when it's so very plain that one can't possibly love God without loving his neighbor. And if he draws a distinction, says St. John, he's an unmitigated liar. Viktor Frankl, who's one of a prominent psychoanalyst today, or I should say a prominent psychiatrist today, following in the analytic school, but has a different emphasis, which he calls logotherapy. And he's fond of quoting the philosopher Nietzsche, that, quote, he who knows the why can bear with any how. He who knows the why can bear with any how. And Frankl's point is that the why is the logos, the Greek word for word or meaning, and that Freud was wrong when he thought that all things could be reduced to the biological and man's needs, or the others were wrong in reducing everything to the sociological in terms of cultural adaptation. Frankl's point is that the need for meaning, the need for purpose, the need for the why is irreducible. And unless this is satisfied in the human being, he will be in anxiety. And he says this is our existential anxiety of this age, that the why has been wiped out. And therefore we're having an awful time dealing with the how without all kinds of stimulations. So that ours can actually be called an addictive age. Well, in the New Testament, it's quite obvious that this word logos is more than a why, because the logos became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Here, then, is an improvement on Nietzsche and Frankl, namely, the who. So the Christian position is that he who knows the who can bear with any how, even though he doesn't know the why. Here is a support that's offered without the why, namely the support of the seal of the Spirit, the inner witness, his spirit bearing witness with our spirit. Irreducible religious essence in relationship. I know whom I believe. And this creates an emotional predisposition to believe. But let's, however, not duck the intellectual problem and explore the intellectual dimension, symptom though it may be. In contrast to child faith, the more the intellect grows, the harder it is to believe. Child faith is innocent faith. By innocent I mean the child doesn't know the problems. Can't know the problems, really. Hasn't got the wherewithal to know. And therefore the child faith can, I think, be described as credulity. A young child will even believe his father and mother are omnipotent. And when you tell them God is, there's no problem. You know, it's the same as telling them there's a chair there. That's innocent faith, credulity. Adult faith is not innocent. We know the problems. And therefore the adult faith can best be described as a leap. A leap in the face of the problems in the direction of faith. And adolescent faith is a painful transition between child faith, which is credulity, and adult faith, which is a leap in the face of obstacles. And that's a very painful transition. Doubts raise questions. But rather than eliminating faith, these very questions may create a more intelligent faith in terms of one's intellectual growth. Faith implies doubt. That is, faith, in contrast to sight, is in a constant tension with doubt, otherwise it wouldn't be faith, but be sight. So to try and eliminate doubt is to try and eliminate faith. To substitute sight, which is basically an offensive faith. So the person who's doubting is facing up to who is the God and what are the beliefs they're finding no longer tenable. And this leads to searching, to discovery for more appropriate mental images of religious concepts that are in line with the growing intellect and personal maturity. And so we have this painful transition into changing mental imagery concerning the being of God, the nature of providence, the function of prayer, the role of Christ in redemption, the Bible as the Word of God, the meaning of the sacrament. New pictures satisfy the growing intellect, even as the older pictures used to satisfy, except that faith's tension with doubt never leaves. Doubt's role changes, however, when one lines up with one's doubt as an affirmation. Then, it is no longer a stimulus to faith, but a replacement of one faith for another. The will has changed now. The commitment has changed. The doubt and faith have reversed themselves. This is a tension we can't escape, no matter what we believe or what we don't believe, and when we don't believe something, we're believing what we don't believe. So, you know, there's no escape from it. And candid atheists have admitted this. C.S. Lewis was continually reminding himself, when he had doubts about his faith in Christ, about his life as an atheist, when he would continually have his doubts about whether God is. And they were just as plaguing as he now found the doubts of whether God isn't. Now, such a shift in youth is often ascribed to intellectual problems. He just could no longer believe, and now he has dropped it all and become some kind of a skeptic. The implication is that the smarter one is, and the more educated that he becomes, the harder it is to believe. And I want to say that this is one of the biggest myths that's been pulled over on us, and I know it. It's not a matter of IQ at all. You can have people with tremendous IQs
who believe in God, and people with tremendous IQs who don't. People with very low IQs who don't. People with very low IQs who do. Life magazine ran an estimated IQ to some of the greats of the ages. And it's rather interesting that the atheist philosopher Voltaire comes out with 190 IQ. And the scientist who was a devout believer, Isaac Newton, comes out with the same IQ. Nor is it a matter of education. We have people with a high degree of education who are believers. People with a high degree of education who are unbelievers. People with very little education are believers, and people with very little education who are not believers. In fact, if you want to push this, you could, there is statistical evidence, there are more people in our churches today, proportionally, of college-educated people than of high school dropouts. So I could imply then that the more education you get, you know, the more your faith grows. But I won't, because I realize this is a middle-class phenomenon. So it's, we'll drop it. Tendency is for middle-class people to be church members. This is a problem we're struggling with, of course, in our witness. Nor is it a matter of hardship. If this person has gone through an awful lot, really, he's had a tough break. He's had a rotten home, and he's had a lousy health, and he's had miserable failures. No wonder he doesn't believe in God. How could he? Turn right around and find somebody else who's got a lousy home and a miserable life and a terrible health and all kinds of failures. He says, if I didn't believe in God, I wouldn't be able to endure it. This has made me more of a believer. So, or nor is it a matter of security. This person has had everything he's ever needed. He's the expression of the affluent society. He has great health and so on. And he doesn't need God, so no wonder he doesn't believe. Well, here's the person who's had all these things, and he testifies to his belief in the midst of all of his blessings. There is one thing, however, we have to face as a reality, I think, and that is that God is no longer in the cultural fabric of our day. And I think this is the meaning, basically, of God is dead. We are in a pluralistic society today, and God has to take his place with all the other interests. I saw a cartoon, I think it was a New Yorker magazine, of two little kids talking, and one of them said to the other, the way I've got it figured out, if God is dead, he must be in heaven. Well, you know, that's one of the problems. That's precisely where he's been for many people, and that's why he's dead. Everything's postponed to eternity. Well, this is the secular city. Harvey Cox is right. It's the secular city, and we're in it. And it's harder to believe today because it isn't in the cultural fabric. It isn't the thing to do. And it's going to be less and less the thing to do. We haven't come to the worst of this yet. He's not a part of the given anymore. At the same time, this may be better. Because it's more in line with faith and less in line with sight. Yet mystery is with us even more. Even though God is no longer a part of our cultural fabric, mystery becomes even more a part of our cultural fabric. Now take the smallest you can get, you know, the atom. We smashed it before we could see it. That's walking by faith and not by sight. And we smashed it, we got the most terrible destructive, constructive power conceivable. Or go to the other extreme, go up to the stratosphere. And while astronomy has replaced astrology, the mystery of the heavens becomes even more. Think of an infinite space. Yeah. This universe, and that comes that universe. All right, now, what do you conceive of as the end of space? Well, then what's on the other side of the end? Or turn it around. Is there no end? Can you conceive of something without an end? It has no end, it has no beginning. Well, then there's Einstein's theory, you know, and it occurs in on itself, and we got some kind of a mysterious cycle going on here. But my problem is, I always ask, what's on the other side of that one? See? I think it's a tremendous analogy here to time and eternity. We've come to almost an infinity in space, which is inconceivable rationally, which I think lends to a very pertinent analogy to an infinity in time. That's what we mean by eternity. Faith is inescapable. The answers that we're seeking are not found in the factual data area. They're just not found there. Answers concerning purpose for living, meaning to life, values to follow. We believe as we are predisposed to believe. That's awfully hard on the intellect to face that. Therefore, let's look at the role of our relationships in our predisposition. Faith is unnatural. We live in a sensory, tangible world of space and time and matter. This is the realm of sight. Things I can perceive with my five senses and measure with my calculations. This world is a natural place for sight, not faith. And this is why faith is called a leap. You leave the concrete, transcendent, in terms of faith. But faith may also be unnatural emotionally. We have an example, I think, in our own culture here of this. The difference in the way we approach girls and boys. Big boys don't cry. I'd do the same thing as a parent. I want my boys to be men. Tough boys. Not mama's boys. Girls, they can cry all they want. My girls cry, they can bother you. That seems to go right on through life that way. Women can admit their weaknesses, admit their tendernesses, let go of their feelings. The man has to hide it all behind a tough masculine armor. The consequence of which is, on the statistics of life insurance tables, the women can count on 5 years of widowhood providing they marry. This has its implications also for religion. It's hard, therefore, for men to accept their own femininity, because none of us is 100% masculine, none of us is 100% feminine. Such would be a caricature of a human being. Within the masculine, there is the feminine, recessive, but nevertheless there, and it's that which enables the man to really relate to a woman on a personal basis. He's got the woman inside of it. But if he can't take the woman inside of it, then he can't very well relate to her outside of it, except in specific ways that transcend what we would call a personal relationship, one of which is sex. Therefore, the man has a hard time facing up to his needs for intimacy, because he's got to be independent. He can't admit weakness. It's awfully hard for a man to come to his pastor and tell him that he's in trouble. The woman comes much easier. In marriage problems, it's the woman who comes twice as much as the man, perhaps. It's hard for the man to face another man and say, I'm failed. No, he grits his teeth and carries on and eats himself out of his side in many ways, one of which is physical. Now, this prior unnaturalness, the unnaturalness of the habitat in which we live, which is a sensory habitat, that we have to accept. That's part of the given. But this emotional unnaturalness, no, we don't have to accept that. That is a distortion of our culture. That can be changed. In, with, and under our human relationships, God is revealed. And this revelation is hindered when we have a defensive fear and resistance to human intimacy. Now, I mentioned sex before as a substitute for human intimacy. And I think it's probably our most favorite substitute. We hold back the self and experience the sexual intimacy apart from personal intimacy. And this is man's predisposition. In our age, I think also it's infecting the woman. Because where a man used to fear nothing more than to be considered something less than a man sexually, I think today our young ladies would fear nothing more than that they might be thought of to be frigid. So whenever the fear exists in these areas, one must overcompensate to prove the fear is not justified. So I think we have today women taking on a rather masculine approach in the area of sex. But all this simply indicates how insecure the feeling is regarding one's femininity, regarding one's masculinity, and how much the fear persists in becoming intimate on a personal level with another person. Let's just put a little question before you here. How many people do you trust, from all the people you know, how many people would you trust to know all about you? How many people would you share? Would you count on it? Maybe that's another reason why we're afraid. We've been either hurt or we've seen others hurt. I've been with people who told me things about people that they had no business telling me about. It was none of my business. And I can't help but wonder, boy, if they knew a little more about me, did I become the topic of conversation someplace where I wasn't present? Oh, no. And I think the man is the most defensive again on trust. Because it's more painful for him to have his weaknesses known. One of the reasons I think we're so critical of the church and of church people, and you can always get a good subject of conversation up with Christians or non-Christians on how the church has failed. Oh, I hear that. I think this is just simply the reverse side of how much we expect from the church. The very fact that we're so prone to criticize it indicates the exalted position it has on the other side of our criticism. The more vulnerable to attack one is, the more expectations there are lost in that person. And so when anybody that's exalted shows any shortcomings, he gets the works. And this also shows how much we need to have those around whom we can respect, whom we can trust. When I ask how many you trust, I'm sure we all wish we could trust more. Maybe part of our problem is our own predisposition not to trust. That needs to be faced also. There's two of us inside of us. I remember once hearing a man say that the existential question today is, be yourself. I mean, the existential affirmation. And he said, now the only problem with that is, which self? Oh, they were so uncomplicated. The one could say, oh, just be yourself. With all the silly suggestions that one has ever heard. I think that's the silly. Which one? Yeah, there are two of us in this old religious area. There's the believer, and there is the defier. There is the receiver, and there is the resister. Help me to believe, we say with one hand. With the other hand, we say, then I dare you to succeed. So we have a need to disprove, a need to reject. I'm thinking now predominantly of the adolescent period here. It certainly can persist all through life. A need to attack authority. And this has its wholesome side. Until I can attack authority, how can I become an authority? But we can get hung up on this business and have what we call an authority problem. Because the authorities have some problems over being attacked. So we can have an attack against anything parental. Order, structure, tradition, dogma, forms, definitions, limitations, codes, anything that goes with the establishment is vulnerable to an attack from the defier in our being. In the name of freedom, we attack these symbols of authority. But this freedom is only known in the defensive, negative concept and use. In other words, this is the kind of freedom that's best shown in how to tackle the one who has the ball. And one wouldn't know what to do if he was ever thrown the ball. I think, well, I say never get over it. We had a congressman who represented us in Iowa, H.R. Gross. You've heard of this great man? To anybody's knowledge, H.R. Gross has never said anything positive in his whole career. But he's always shown what's wrong with him. And somebody asked him that when he visited Wartburg College on one occasion. How come you're always against? Well, he says, I'll be honest with you. He says, this is my forte. I can see what's wrong with things, even though I don't know what's right. So at least he was handy with that. I could call it hung up adolescence or arrested development. I better be careful. I wrote something rather facetiously sarcastic about Gross once in the letters to the editor, and I got so many letters in back, a vehement protest that kind of shook me for a while. So if you're a fan of H.R. Gross, let me say that as long as we just have one of them in the house, I think it's fine. I'm all for it. But the very fact that this idea of freedom is shown in this negative use, you see, in adolescence, shows where one has felt the pressure. We're fighting the form because the forms have been the pressure, the labels rather than the essence, the spirit. Forms are symbols of restriction, and therefore they bring out an automatic resistance. So therefore it's possible, you see, to have the essence even though one's fighting the form. It's possible to be a believer even when one is fighting the forms. I really don't know. Doubt also rises from disappointment. We expect so much in our age from life. Just like we expect so much from marriage. This is the affluent society, and you know, the sky is the limit and so on. And therefore we're bound to be disappointed. Particularly, I think, now in our middle-class strata of society. And disappointments bring depressions, discouragement, and doubt. We've had some great doubters in our times. Take Job. When Job had his doubts, however, he never doubted the existence of God. You can look all through the book, as I'm sure Dr. Cross has probably told you, and you don't find any doubts about, is there a God? But what you find all over the place is, what kind of a God have I got? Is he devil or not? And so we attack, and Job attacked him on the basis of his character rather than on the basis of whether he was or not. Then there's Luther, who had terrific doubts about God in terms of salvation. But he never doubted that there was salvation. What he doubted was, how could he possibly qualify for it? So Luther attacked himself. Today, we don't ask, what kind of a God do I have so much? Or, how can I qualify for salvation so much? But we doubt whether there is a God or not, or whether there's anything to qualify for or not. We attack the system and lament life's meaninglessness and emptiness. It's a difference between a pre-scientific and a scientific age, between a secularized culture and a sacred-oriented culture. The Elihu tried to get through to Job and said, God doesn't speak just in one way, but in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. There are cultural blindnesses in our day to perceiving it due to our emotional isolation. are cut off from intimacy in the midst of a great deal of gregarious relating on the surface predisposes us to blocks in the area of belief. And God may be speaking in one way and in two, though our culture does not perceive it. Frankl's irreducible need, the need for meaning, comes through knowing oneself and knowing others. And Frankl found it in a Nazi concentration camp. And I think that it's quite foundational to say that this shows there's no limitations to fighting. Because if there's anything that would be the epitome of disappointment, it would seem to me, it would be life in a Nazi concentration camp. But in our day, we have a low threshold of disappointment. We can't take much of it. A low threshold of frustration. Because we're lacking in intimate relationships. Frankl was sustained in the midst of his frustration by thinking tenderly of the wife with whom he was in. And then from there to the God for whom he bowed, in his own words, in prayer. But you see, where there is no intimate relating, no knowing of others, there's no knowing of self, there's no self-identity, and therefore there's no ego strength, if you want to use those words, to deal with frustrations. And therefore there's a quick flare up and panic and despair, and the need for a quick relief in some kind of distraction in our addictive age. This brings us to the role of the will, the motivation in faith. There are those who will not to believe. They would be, first of all, doubters that are hurting. Their needs are not being met. And Job is a good example of this. And he's angry. He's too angry to believe. And there are doubters who are not hurting. They have no needs that need to be met. They are getting along fine. They haven't even any self-doubts because everything seems to be going fine. They're happily married. They've got a good job. They've got a great future. I talked to a young fellow who spoke just like this not so long ago. It's a very tenuous no need situation. If he lives long enough, he's going to have a different perspective. It isn't the kind of world you can keep that up in very long. If he doesn't have it in young adulthood, he's bound to get it in the midlife crisis if he lives that long. Then there are those who are past hurt. They just don't have any feelings anymore at all. They've just been shocked out of having any feelings. They don't dare to feel. A good example of that, if you saw us have seen the pawnbroker, also from a concentration camp. What a different approach or outcome. Or Camus, the stranger, who couldn't feel. Therefore had no response at all to the priest's appeal to believing in God because he was going to die. Make any difference? Life, death, what's the difference? Don't feel anything. Past hurting because one's been hurt too much. And then those whose way of life is hurting. Like the young fellow who told me that every time he believed there was no God, he got the most wonderful, peaceful feeling he'd ever known. Until he had any doubts. And I asked him why, if he knew why. He said, yeah, there is a God. I'm AWOL. Absent without a place to leave. Belief in God just made him very upset because he felt guilty when he thought of God. And the only way to get rid of his guilt, which is a painful thing, was to get rid of God, which is a psychological basis for a good deal of atheism. And there are those whose self-rejection is too great for the good news to be received. And that would be Luther, whose pride was in the way. He couldn't be the kind of person he wanted to be. And he wasn't interested in forgiveness, he was interested in qualifying until his great experience. Now there's integrity in that. And Job had it. And when he argued with Eliphaz appealed to him to play it safe. You know, we've often said, what do you got to lose? If your doubts are right, all right, then you end up with nothing. But what if they're wrong? Better get in line, Jill. You know, be a good boy. Now, come along. Everything will be fine. We'll forget all this. Fussing is done. And you get all these rewards. Job wouldn't buy it. He said, I only have one thing left, and that's my integrity, my self-respect. And if I would surrender that for a mess of pottage, I'd have nothing. And yet he was responsible for his choice. In spite of the integrity of doubt, we're responsible for our choice. For all choices have consequences. You can't escape them. And I said that to this young man who had no needs. And he said, why should I believe in God? I don't need him. And I said, well, there's more to it than need. If God is, whether you need him or not, he is. And there are consequences to whether you believe or not. I looked at him and said, are you trying to scare me into heaven? I said, oh, no. Well, actually, I was. This defiance, you see, is a demand that I remain independent. And that's looked upon as strength. Whereas surrender is a dependence and is looked upon as weakness. And any intimidation that the authorities may use, and I'm thinking now of religious authorities, is a tempting pressure on the doubter. But I am convinced that whenever we use it and we succeed, we're simply sowed the seeds for later rebellion. When the intimidation is no longer intimidating. Fear is only good as a motivation as long as one is afraid. What happens when one must no longer? Believing, therefore, centers in the will. And there are inferior motives in either believing or in unbelieving, or not believing, or doubting. In a sense, we believe because we want to, and we don't believe because we don't want to. And the support for our faith or for our doubt comes after our decision. And that's the meaning of faith. The support comes through involvement. Through involvement, our personal involvement. For example, in the ALC's latest report on communion practices, much is made of the fact that the Greek word for remembrance, this doing remembrance of me, is more correctly translated reactualization. Why? Because one just isn't thinking about something. One has become involved in the drama. He is a participant. And that's a tremendous difference than sitting on the sidelines and thinking. God is not found. He reveals himself. We're not playing a game of hide and seek. For playing any game would be called launch out into the deep. In other words, carry on, brother, even though you're only muddling through. Carry on. Jesus said, if any man's will is to do his will, he shall know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. If any man's will is to do his will, he shall know. Paul Homer, who's written one of these books for Luther Youth Research, which I don't believe is out yet, and I happen to, through Dr. Stroman, read the galleys, or the manuscript. But his big point, as I perceived it, was that the conditions that produced the sayings of faith among the apostles, these conditions have to be realized by each person before these sayings of the apostles, these sayings of faith become his sayings. When our way of life lines up with our faith, with beliefs, they make sense. C.S. Lewis, again, said that before he was a Christian, he thought the most ridiculous thing he ever heard of was the substitutionary doctrine of the atonement, that God would punish Christ for my sins so that I could be tolerated by God. Yeah, that funniest thing you ever heard. You ever thought of that weird deal? God has to send his son and punish him before he can take me. But he said, after he became a Christian, he realized that, first of all, this was only one of many ways of looking at the atonement.
And secondly, it didn't seem so stupid, because he could see what was meant by the imagery, which he couldn't see before, because his experience of involvement had brought his intellect. Our intellect is based upon our experiences. The deeper the experiences, the more we can understand. Can't understand experience of faith unless one has been involved. It's nonsense. The closest, therefore, we can come to certainty is through involvement and participation, launching out into the deep. Well, Kierkegaard says, taking the most difficult doctrine of all, the ascension, you so commit yourself and so live that the ascension has to be true. You've gone out to live. Faith, therefore, is a confidence that supports a way of life that is expressed by a creed. Faith is a confidence that supports a way of life that is expressed by a creed. A faith that believes that with God all things are possible, even believing in God. Well, that's all I have to say. And I believe our time is up. So we break now for the next session.